Amen. Awesome. Thank you. All right. We are developing the second level of interpretation more thoroughly. So we have looked at the dating of the gospel, situated them in the Roman world in the first century. And now what we're doing is we're taking a look at the way in which the Roman world has received Christ, or received, or even discusses the Christians as a whole. Yesterday, we didn't look at, I read to you because our wonderful technology wasn't working. So forget the iPads. I always forget. Never rely on an Apple to do a PC job. That's just always something I got to remind myself. Nothing? No? Okay. But we read Josephus yesterday, and Josephus was describing to us what was happening at the time of Festus's death. Albinus was but upon the road. So Ananus, which is the high priest at the time, he brings Jesus, or the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some of his companions before the Sanhedrin. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. And so we started looking at the different things that we can take from this, of what it is that the Roman world, or in this case a Jewish writer, but Jewish Roman, is confirming or even contributing to what it is we have in the gospel accounts. We have Jesus referenced as Christ. Now, I mentioned yesterday, it is not as if Josephus, though, is affirming Jesus' Messiah-ship. Okay? He's calling, or he is saying, who was called Christ. But we see Josephus seeming to indicate that Vespasian is Messiah on some level. And I wanted to give you those texts so that you actually can see what I'm talking about. In Jewish War, 6.288 through 289, Josephus writes this. He says, "Thus it was that the wretched people were deluded at that time by charlatans and pretended messengers of God." Now, he's talking about the people around the destruction of the temple. So the Jewish people. He's saying they have been deluded by people pretending to be messengers of God, which is why they fought to the very end. He says, "While they neither heeded nor believed in the manifest portents," so the omens that were being, that were indicating a shift in power, the omens that should have been read as signs from God indicating who he is sided with, "they neither heeded nor believed in the manifest portents," or omens, "that foretold the coming desolation of Jerusalem and the temple. But, as if thunderstruck and bereft of eyes and mind, disregarded the plain warnings of God. So, it was when a star," and I have that highlighted and in bold, "when a star resembling a sword stood over the city, and a comet which continued a year." He's referring to the signs or the portents that are pointing towards God's revelation. So, he also mentions just a little bit later, he says, "But what more than all else incited them to the war was an ambiguous oracle, likewise found in their sacred scriptures, to the effect that at that time one from their country would become ruler of the world." Now we're going to ask the question, what oracle is he referring to? And it's going to tie together what he says in this passage as well as what he is saying here. "This they understood to mean someone of their own race, and many of their wise went astray in their interpretation of it. The oracle, however, in reality, signified the sovereignty of Vespasian, who was proclaimed emperor on Jewish soil." Now, I have several things highlighted for a particular reason. Remember the passage that Simon ben Koseba was used to be turned into or renamed Simon bar Kokhba? Do you remember the passage from the Old Testament that we mentioned? What was it? Numbers. Come on, we can do this. Numbers. Anybody? 24, verses 17 and following. Let me read this. With these in mind, the things I have highlighted, let me read this text. "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter," or a sword, "will rise out of Israel. He will crush the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of all the people of Sheth. Edom will be conquered. Sire, his enemies, will be conquered. But Israel will grow strong. A ruler will come out of Jacob and destroy the survivors of the city. Now, they were using this, Numbers 24, 17 through 19, later in 132 to 135, referring to Bar Kokhba. But it seems to be here, the language that we see in Josephus, notice, the language we see in Josephus, he seems to be applying Numbers 24, 17 through 19 to which person? Vespasian. He says, the mistake they made was that actually they were looking somebody from their own race to rise out of their country and to destroy people. In reality, it is Vespasian's work in suppressing the rebellion in our land, where he rises like a star and a scepter out of Jerusalem, out of Judea, to take sovereignty and power over the whole world. You see what Josephus just did? He used a retrospective messianic text to validate Vespasian's reign, which is a pretty startling move. So to suggest that in the initial quote that Vespasian is referring to Jesus as the Christ is a bit of a stretch. No, he seems to have his lot thrown in with Vespasian as a messianic figure. Okay? Josephus also later, this is the most famous text of Josephus as far as its interaction with Christ and Christians. In Antiquities 18, 63 through 64, this is written around the early 90s. He says, about this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Messiah. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing amongst us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day he appeared to them, restored to life, for the prophets of God had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him. And the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. What do you notice about all those in bold and italicized sections that I even changed my voice on when I was reading them? What do you notice about them? Why do they stick out? Those are very Christian statements. They seem very un-Josephus-like. They're very Christian statements, aren't they? I mean, what we just read about his understanding of Vespasian, isn't it a little strange that right in the middle of this, he's like, Jesus was the Messiah. Like, boldly, prominently. Or, if indeed we ought to even call him a man. It's kind of like, what, is Josephus converting? On the third day he appeared to them, restored to life. For the prophets of God had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him. And you're like, wait a minute, what? No, more than likely, and I agree with scholars on this, more than likely each of those statements are what's called an interpolation. You'll see this a lot of the times in different scholarly works. Interpolation. A Christian interpolation, an insertion that's been inserted into the text. So as it has been transmitted and preserved, at times there's also been interpolations, insertions. Because honestly, with what else, where else we find discussions of Christ or of Christians or even of a messianic figures throughout Josephus, this text does not jive with all the rest of them. It just doesn't in those portions. So what I want us to do is I want us to not look at those. I want us to, in our minds, delete those and ask this question. Is this text, though, still valuable? And if so, how? What do we get from this text that contributes to our understanding of the Jewish Jewish-Roman understanding of Christ? How does it compare to the Gospels? What do we see? Okay, an inclusiveness between Greek and Jew. Good. What else do we see? Good. Because he won over many Jews and many Greeks, right? That's actually a pretty startling thing, even in the Roman world. Just ask Alexandria, Jamnia, and Dora. Cities where there were Jewish-Greek tension. Sorry. What else do you see? Just say what you see on the very surface levels. Every detail matters. Start at the very first line. What do you see? Okay, there is somebody referenced as a Jesus from a Jewish-Roman source that is being affirmed. That's actually important. What else do you see? Wise. You know what's interesting? We will find that as a common theme. Even though Jesus will be downplayed by Jews and Romans, there is a consensus of him being a wise man, a wise teacher. They put him in the category of a wise, almost sage-like figure, which is fascinating. What else do you see? You can move out of the first line if you want.
It's interesting how it says, if indeed one ought to call him a man.
Yeah, we're going to act like that doesn't exist, though, because I think that's more than likely a Christian insertion. Because Josephus would have called him a man. Mm-hmm. So we have this tension of actions and words and coming together. The surprising feats is a way of referring to miracles without saying miracles. It was an interesting event. So it's a non-committal way of saying, I don't have an explanation, but there could be one, but it was surprising nonetheless. However, his teaching component is a part of what we see. In other words, does this remind us of the Gospels? Yeah. The words and deeds interplay, constantly moving back and forth as he is giving wise teaching. You see this teaching component as something that the people even accepted gladly. So he's talking about, at least on some level, a following of some sort. Alex.
Is there also not a denial over his impact?
Yes. Yeah, they are not in denial over the impact. As a matter of fact, I mean, he's saying he actually won over many Jews and many of the Greeks, which is interesting. Now skip that he was the Messiah. What else do you see? No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't explain it at all. Now, what's interesting about that is maybe it's because he doesn't know. We'll see that in Pliny the Younger later. It's possible, but what do we also, what's the inverse of what you just said? What does he affirm? Yeah, he was accused, condemned, and crucified under Pontius Pilate. You see that? He actually is invoking a Roman ruler's name in connection with this person's condemnation. You're going to see that. That is a widely known fact in the Jewish-Roman texts, that Jesus was not just accused and condemned, but it was Pilate-connected, which I think is interesting that we also find that almost exact phrasing inside of the early creeds of the church. So when Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing amongst us, what else does that affirm? What's that? Yep, and it is the Jewish leaders, the Pharisee, the important figures of their society that condemn him, that accuse him at least, I guess I should say. It is exactly the impetus that we see in the Gospels. The Jewish leaders accusing Jesus before Pontius Pilate that leads to his condemnation and crucifixion. It affirms the fact of the way in which he was killed. He was crucified. Those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. What does that indicate?
Well, it implies that there was some validity to this person that made him worthwhile to commit to.
Okay, initially, at least on some level. And then it was such a... that some people perceived this validity as so important that it even was an enduring component after his death. They still had an affection for him. Now, exactly what that word affection means, he doesn't delineate all that clearly. Nevertheless, he is saying they still believed with him after he died, which reminds me of Acts. Yeah? Now, we're going to skip over that other bolded part because more than likely that was a Christian interpolation. But let's move down to that last line. And the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. What does that indicate to us? What is that telling us? Say it again. It's lasting. He has a lasting effect. What else does it tell us? That Josephus himself, even in the early 90s, is indicating that he probably has encountered them. They're still around his proximity to the point where he can mention them by name. That's interesting too. He says their name, Christians. And he also gives us the origin of their name, doesn't he? What's the origin of their name? Christ, called after him, the one that was crucified, that has a lasting, enduring impact on the Jewish Roman world. So in other words, even if we take out all the bold, it's not as if we don't get anything from this. We actually get quite a lot. We're able to start to see more clearly how the Jews and Romans interacted with, or at least viewed, this Christian group, how they received them. There is a clarity and an ambiguity that you're going to see in a lot of these texts. A clarity, I mean, especially here, I mean, my goodness, they're called Christian after his name. We even know who he was killed under, how he was killed. We even know that he did surprising feats and was a teacher, that he was accused by these groups. They know a lot. But notice there's also this ambiguity, surprising feats. It doesn't tell us what he was teaching exactly. It does tell us in some sense they indicated that, that his name, Christ, is what eventually becomes their name. So therefore, there's some sort of understanding of how they viewed him and maybe what the teachings entailed. But there is both clarity and ambiguity, which will be important once we get later into the second century. But that's Josephus. This is making sense. You guys also start to understand how I'm wanting you to interact with each of these texts, because we're going to go through like 30 of these on the screen of how to understand the value of these texts. Is this making sense? And developing this second area more clearly. Okay? Yes. And that's even where the wise man, it's one of those things where they're not suggesting that everything Jesus said was just straight lies. That there is some wisdom to this. There is some truth. It's just that either the believers have taken it too far, or maybe Jesus overstepped his bounds a time or two. But yeah, it's more of a mixture of. Matter of fact, we'll see it later. It's kind of the categories they put like a Socrates in. I mean, they're not calling him to be like a rabbi. It's just that, but he's a wise teacher. He said some good things, was very helpful. We'll see that later with the letter of Marabar Serapion to his son, which will be helpful to process more. Oh, there was something else I was going to say. Oh, but note it, remember the date of this text. When is it? Early 90s. Why is that significant? What was happening during that time as far as Gospels are concerned? Say it again. Yet three are already written, and unless Luke's just publishing his, but and then John is being written. So you have remember I talked about the second level of interpretation. Is whenever the documents were first received. We have the first set. We're not really going all the way back to 30. We're going back about the time the Gospels were being written or were recently written, which tells us something about the world in which the Gospels were interacting with. One that they were known but not really known. But a Jew seems to know them a lot better. Matter of fact, and this will be helpful once we see the contrast with the next one. This is Suetonius. Write it in Claudius 25.4, which Claudius was the emperor that reigned at what time? Does anybody know that? Claudius. close. It's the one right after that one. That one's Caligula, 39 to 41. Claudius starts to reign in 41. 54. 41 to 54. Who reigns after Claudius? Nero. So that puts you in an idea of where this is. And he's describing about an event that happens in 49. So, 49, you're about 15 to 20 years after Jesus. It's also whenever Paul's ministry is really ramping up. He'll be writing some of his documents in the 50, you know, early 50s. This is the event right before this. This is also the event that is even referenced later on in the book of Acts, in reference to Acts 18, in reference to even Priscilla and Aquila and why he finds them, where he finds them. That's this event. But notice a couple of things. You see Suetonius says this, since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from Rome. Claudius expelled them from Rome. What do you notice about this? Do with this what it is we just did with Josephus. Give me every detail you can see inside each of the words. What do you see? What? There's Jews in Rome. That's helpful to know. Causing trouble. Notice the perception of the Jews, or I mean of the Romans of the Jews. Does that make sense? How do the Romans view them? Well, at this point, in 49, the Romans are reviewing them as causing disturbances in the city of Rome. What else do you see? Crestus. Interesting word. A lot of scholarly debate over this. I'll tell you where the consensus is now, and this is where I'm at. Crestus is a Latin misspelling of the word Christus, for the Greek Christos, which we would translate as Christ. That's more than likely what this is. Now notice, though, my emphasis. It is a misspelling. Why is that interesting to me? Say it again. It shows how much they know. And what does that indicate that they know? They know enough to get in the ballpark where we can identify it retrospectively. But they don't know enough to be able to spell it all right. You see the interesting part of that. Now, here's what's even more fascinating. He's describing on the first level an event that happens in 49. But Suetonius is writing at the beginning of the second century. Why is that interesting to me? Or what is important about that? The difference between level 1 and level 2 of Suetonius. It was a significant enough event on the level 1 that Suetonius feels the need to record it. But level 2, what does it tell me about whenever the people are first receiving this? How do they understand the Christians? Do you understand my question? Does that make sense? Level one is, this is a significant enough event that Claudius had to make an edict to kick all of the Jews out of Rome because of this Crestus disturbance. But the problem is, he's right in the beginning of the second century, and he knows, but he doesn't know. Remember, the whole point of this is to see how the Romans are receiving the Christians inside of the context that the gospel is being written shortly before and shortly after. He knows, but doesn't really know. Because if he really knew, he wouldn't be making a blunder as clear as Crestus. Is that making sense? He knows, but he doesn't know. Yeah?
Are the Jews being associated with the Christians?
I guess it depends on what you mean by the word associated. They are connected through contention. Yes, you see what I mean by that? But are they being synonymously associated? No. What this tells me is this. The Jews were really upset, probably maybe amongst themselves, because of the instigation of Crestus. Maybe he even thinks it's a person at the time that was living in Rome during Claudius' reign. The instigation of Crestus, maybe he thinks it's a person like that's alive in 49. But the way he indicates it on some level is that they're making disturbances because of this issue amongst themselves that's causing problems in Rome that led to the point of Claudius finally saying, get out of here. So there's an association, but exactly what that association is to be more guessed than solidified. But knowing that this is written at the beginning of the second century tells us even about the familiarity of the Romans, of the Christians and the Jews on this particular issue, even into the second century, even after Revelation is written. They know, but they don't know. Okay? They know, but they don't know. It's we've got like 15 minutes. I saw several of you look back. I'll just let you know. That's where we're at. Okay? Every move you make, I get to see. It's awesome. Very encouraging at times, too. The next one comes from Tacitus. Tacitus is writing around the same time as Suetonius, beginning of the second century. Tacitus is writing about the fire in Rome in 64. So that's the first level, 64, the fire in Rome under Nero. Second level, though, he's at the beginning of the second century. Now, it's going to be interesting because Tacitus seems like he has a little bit more of an understanding than Suetonius, even though they're contemporaries in the second century. Tacitus says this, "But all human efforts, all the lavish gifts of the emperor and the propitiations of the gods did not banish the sinister belief that the conflagration was the result of an order." In other words, it didn't matter what the emperor did or how often he offered sacrifices on behalf of the gods, you know, asking them to take away their wrath from the fire of Rome. People still believed that the fire was a result of an order of the emperor. You hear what he said? Nero's their target. They're not happy with him. Consequently, to get rid of the report that he was responsible for the fire of Rome, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations. Now, I have it on there. Do I have it? No, I deleted it. Okay. In my notes, I have it. A one next to that. Because this is such a long quote, I almost want us to process it as we go. Okay? What does that indicate? Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations. Easy scapegoat because they were hated. So he's going to try to find somebody that everybody's going to agree on. Yeah, let's get rid of this person or this group. Let's attack them for this. We all hate him for abominations. Now, what that exactly is, you will see guessed at. But on some level, what it is, it's a rejection of Roman society of who the Christians were or what they did. Now, once we get into the second century, mid to late second century, you will see clear accusations against Christians that are pretty startling, like accusing Christians of being cannibals. That will be going around. I mean, they drink the blood and eat the flesh of their leader. You'll hear Christians being accused of incestuous orgies, that whenever they go and they have their secretive meetings, it's incestuous because even if it's their brother or their sister, their father, their mother, their wife, or their husband, everybody calls each other brother and sister. These people are disgusting. They refer to them as anarchists because they're denying the presence of the gods and refusing them worship. There are abominations that are attached to Christians later on in the second century that would make the Roman society hate them. But he fastens in guilt and inflicts the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Now that's interesting. Calls Christians by whom? Who calls them Christians? The populace. I think that's fascinating. The Christians throughout the book of Acts primarily refer to themselves as what? The way. It's in Antioch in Acts 13 that we first see the name Christian appear. And we only see Christian used maybe once or twice. Well, we see it one other time in the book of Acts and one other time outside of the book of Acts. The majority of the name that the Christians refer to themselves as is not Christian, even though that's the name we hear now. That, from my understanding, is that's what was called, that's what the Christians were called by the people in a sense, even in a pejorative sense, a negative sense, kind of like calling them a name. Oh, you're just a little Christ. And Christians were like, yeah, that'll work. That's fine. We'll call ourselves that. That's okay. But they're called Christians by the populace, which I find interesting. Christus, what did he just do? He spelled it right in the Latin transliteration compared to his contemporary Suetonius. So it seems like Tacitus either has a more striking familiarity with this group, or he at least has better sources than what Suetonius does, even though they're writing at the same time and in service of the same emperor. They're both writing for Trajan. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, which reminds me of what text we've already read. What text indicated that? Josephus. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius. That just gave us a little bit more of a detail we haven't received before yet. He gives us the name of the emperor that this Christus suffers an extreme penalty, which is an indirect way of referring to what? The crucifixion. Notice how the Romans even refer to a crucifixion. I find that quite interesting. They don't see it as, oh, you know, and he was just crucified. They're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He received the extreme penalty. The penalty of all penalties. What we normally reserve for very special occasions. That's who this Christus received. That's what this Christus received. Suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. Or Pontius Pilatus. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea. Stop. What is this mischievous superstition that broke out? Seems like a resurrection. You see what he's admitting to? Admitting without admitting it. This ridiculous superstition broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of that evil. Notice how they're even referring to the resurrection. But even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. I love that. I love the way he refers to Rome. Reminds me of the way in which people in the Midwest refer to like New York. I go, everything just ridiculous starts in New York. It always finds a home there. That's kind of the way he's like, it's the hub. It's the hub that generates a synergy of culture and of civilization and of thinking that spins out. But the problem is that what spins out isn't the only things that actually exist inside of it. Sometimes things go inside of it and they may find a home, but hopefully they'll be expelled. It's how he's referring to Rome. Oh boy, and they even made it all the way to Rome. Goes all the way from Judea, remember our map, makes it all the way over to Rome. In the ancient world, that's kind of a big deal. He says, but it seems like it's checked at least at this point. A most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment. So he believes at the beginning of the second century, what? That the craziness belief of the resurrection by the Christians at this point, we've got it under control. Well, it's no threat anymore. Everything's okay. Oh, famous last words. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Pleaded guilty to what? Notice the context of this. The fire in 64 by Nero, trying to find somebody to blame it on. He blames it on the Christians. The arrest is first made of all who pleaded guilty to what? Yes. Oh, dang, there you go, sorry. Pleaded guilty to what? Maybe the fire? Maybe to being a Christian. It's just ambiguous enough that we don't really know. So pleaded guilty to maybe the fire, but if he's attached it to a people group, all he would need is a confession that they belong to the group that's responsible for the fire. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted. What does that tell me? An immense multitude, what? A lot of people, what? Are Christians in Rome during the fire of 64. When is the book of Mark being written? Mid to late 60s, at a time where things were getting pretty tense, and an immense multitude is right in the mouth of the beast, right in the heart of the center of Rome. An immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city, oh, this is an honest moment, as of hatred against mankind. Convicted not even so much of the fire of the city, but just because we hate the way they hate all of us. How do they hate you? Well, whenever you are threatening the prosperity of the entire empire by not worshiping the gods, you become a national security issue. You see what he's saying? Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Remember, this is the context of the Gospel of Mark being written. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his gardens for the spectacle and was exhibiting a show in the circus while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or stood aloft on a car. Hence, even for criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, this is fascinating, there arose a feeling of compassion for these Christians. For it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty that they were being destroyed. In other words, initially, yeah, let's get them. They hate us, let's destroy them. But then the way they were being destroyed, systematically and viciously, eventually the populace started saying, okay, enough's enough. Enough's enough. It's not even like you're really punishing them for what they did or for even their hatred. It's almost just like to appease your own lust. It starts to shift, which tells you the intensity of the way in which they were being treated. Is this making sense? And it's where, again, I want to remind us of the ending of the book of Mark. The women walked away from the tomb, terrified and confused, and they said nothing to anyone about what they had seen. And the book of Mark ends going, what are you going to do? In a situation like this, what are you going to do? Are you going to walk away like the women did at the end of the book? Because you know the way the story ended on that one, right? They actually did tell someone. But let's just set that aside for a minute. What if they walked away terrified and confused and said nothing to anyone ever? Then what? Yeah, but the situation is so dire. Yeah, I know. On the comparable level of a crucifixion of your leader in a very mocking and brutal way. But remember what this is. This is the beginning of the good news of Jesus the Christ, the true Son of God. That's how Mark's gospel begins. In a context like this, we see the gospel being inserted, and it gives a different type of density when we read it from the second level. First level is intense enough, but the second level, when you add this in, it puts a different character or color on the text. We're able to engage it with a different intensity. Because look at the different things, oh, I need to go to the previous slide, the different ways in which the Christians were even referred to. I mean, their abominations that they did, mischievous superstitions, their hatred against mankind, the way that then they were even treated. Initially, it was even accepted until finally Nero took it too far, which he always tends to do. If this is the context of the way in which the document was received, it adds a level of density when Jesus says things like in Mark 8, you know, take up your cross and follow me. They literally were doing this in the 60s. Literally. Or it changes some of the ways in which you read the book of Acts later, when he talks about engaging the wild beasts. Or even in Ephesians, when Paul references that. Because shortly after Ephesians, they will, and shortly before the book of Acts is written, they did. You see how this second level is super important for interpretation? You will not read your Gospels the same if you have the second level firmly in place. It adds a different character to it, character to it, that deepens not just the picture, but the call to us, the call to us. We'll talk about that more on Tuesday. Love you guys. See you then.